Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Marcellaro, and this week my guest is NASA planetary scientist, Dr. Pascal Lee. Pascal, welcome to the show.
Good to be on your show, John. Thank you.
Thank you for joining me. This is an honor. You are a very distinguished scientist. For the listeners, I will kind of give an introduction here. You are a planetary scientist at the SETI Institute. We'll talk about SETI. You are also chairman and founder of the Mars Institute and director of the NASA Houghton Mars Project at NASA Ames Research Center in Mountain View, California. Your research focuses on the history of water on Mars and on the planning of future human exploration of Mars. You're the author or co-author of over 100 scientific publications, and you have a PhD in astronomy and space sciences from Cornell University. Wow. Very impressive. And more. And there's more to talk about. But I always like to ask astrophysicists and planetary scientists how they get started. What inspired them when they were younger? I know you grew up in Hong Kong, and we'll talk about your migration. But was there an event or an inspiration or a person when you were young growing up that really got you wound up into this?
I was born in Hong Kong. I spent my little childhood in Hong Kong. And if you want to be an astronomer, it's almost the worst place to grow up in. It's an urban jungle, and it's all about banking, really, and business. It's not an astronomy-type town, although over the years it sort of has become more academic as well. But when I grew up there, those were the days of Bruce Lee. And my early inspiration about space came from the TV set. So I was an avid follower of Star Trek.
American television in Hong Kong.
Yes, Lost in Space, but also British TV, like the Thunderbirds, you know, the puppet.
Oh, I remember that.
Science fiction series. And that's what got me into sort of inspired by the science world, the tech world, and space travel was just sort of an obvious thing. And then when I was a little kid, I remember the first steps humans took at the surface of the moon. And from that day on, I thought, one day I too shall go to this land where people travel to the moon, which was America.
So then you decided that you needed to go to Paris to continue your education. How did that happen?
Yeah, so my mother was French. My father was originally Chinese, but my mother was French. And so I was not doing very well in Hong Kong in school. There were 44 kids in the classroom, and I was consistently ranking 43rd. So my parents sat me down and said, hey, how about we put you in a boarding school in France? And the only question I asked them was how I was going to go to France. And he said, well, I was just going to fly there. And the immediate answer from that was yes. So I flew to France. I went to boarding school. I spent 15 years in a Catholic boarding school in France, and I became a good student. a better student. And then I went to college in Paris. I studied physics at the University of Paris, then geology. Got a master's in geology and geophysics at the University of Paris.
At that time, were you thinking about physics and geology as in their own right, or were you already planning on a future in planetary sciences and you saw these as prerequisites?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. So by then, I was already sort of planning to be a planetary scientist. In fact, what made me decide to become a planetary scientist was reading when I was still in boarding school, after curfew at night, under my blankets, The Cosmic Connection by Carl Sagan. That was a page turner for me and a total inspiration. So this was before even the Cosmos series came out and the book The Cosmos. This was one of his earlier books.
I remember one of my Bibles as an undergraduate in astrophysics was the book with Sagan and Shklovsky.
Oh, yeah.
Search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Yeah. Intelligent life in the universe. Yeah.
That was a Bible.
Yeah, that is a Bible still. It's an awesome book. But The Cosmic Connection is sort of more of a autobiography by Carl of his experience as a planetary scientist, seeing for the first time pictures arriving from Mars. And basically, I wanted to do that kind of work. That's what inspired me. So from then on, it was a sort of almost straightforward. I studied physics and geology in Paris. And then in France, at the time, we still had a draft. Young men still had to do a year of national service. So I applied 3 years in advance for this one special position they had for scientists in France for their draft, which was to go spend 1 year in Antarctica.
Was there heated competition for that, or did you sort of like the only one who wants to go to the South Pole?
it's sort of both, because I remember when I was telling my friends, hey, guess what? I'm going to Antarctica for my national service. And most of them had the look like, I mean, looked like they were wondering what harm I had done to be deserving that.
Well, my wife has been there 3 times, and I know the ordeal. I haven't experienced it, but I've secondhand experienced what an ordeal that is.
But probably the appeal as well, right?
Yes, absolutely.
It's an amazing place. So, applying for that is both an easy thing, because not a lot of people want to go, but there's only one slot per year for a scientist doing their national service to go to Antarctica. That's actually somewhat tough. So anyway, I was lucky. I like I said, I applied 3 years ahead of time, so I showed some perseverance there, and then I got the posting. But that was a life changing experience for me to spend a year. I mean, Antarctica is like another planet, really, especially when you winter over there. So I was at the French base, straight south from Tasmania, Australia, there for a year. And and on my way south, we stopped in Singapore, and I posted at Singapore airport my application for one graduate school in the United States, and that was to Cornell. And
you knew you wanted to go to Cornell because?
Well, because I had read Carl's books, and
yeah,
by then,
you know,
he had made, you know, planetary science such an attractive field.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, by then I had also read up a lot more about planetary science. So I actually did not ask him to be my advisor. I was looking forward to being the student of Joe Vavirka, who was his postdoc. Was one of his postdoctoral students, who was by then a professor at Cornell. So I wanted to work with Joe. But anyway, I submit my application, and sometime in the middle of that winter in Antarctica, I get this telex. This was before the internet days. I get this 70-word telex from France saying that I had received a letter of acceptance to go to Cornell in the following fall. So I was thrilled. That was the beginning of my American dream.
Wow. So was there a problem migrating? Did you have to become a U.S. citizen, or did you just come over on a visa? How did all that work?
I came over on a student visa. And in fact, the reason why it was an immediate American dream is, you know, all these years in France, I had grown up following, for example, the journey of the Voyager 1 and 2 spacecraft. In 79 and 81, Voyager 1 and 2 flew by Jupiter and then Saturn. And then eventually in 86, Voyager 2 flew by Uranus. And then in 89, in August of 89, Voyager 2 was going to do its final flyby of Neptune. And I showed up at Cornell campus on 15th of August of 89, just 2 weeks before the final encounter with Neptune. And my advisor, Joe, who was on the camera team of Voyager 2, said, "Hey, Pascal, don't unpack. Would you like to come with us to Pasadena for the next month and look at pictures of Triton, which is one of the moons of the large moon of Neptune, being returned by the Voyager 2 spacecraft?" And can you imagine my answer?
Oh, yeah.
So all these years, this mission had been sort of the backdrop of what drew me to planetary science, because it was such an exciting mission of discovery. And then here I was going to be part of the final flyby.
Wow. Amazing. So what happened next in your evolution after you graduated then with a PhD?
Well, graduate school, you got to work through that. I now I now give the following advice to people who are contemplating going to graduate school in planetary science, which is that the best thing you can get out of graduate school is yourself. but that's really a joke. I got a lot out of graduate school. And in fact, one of the things I really enjoyed was finally being able to meet Carl Sagan. He was by then beginning to be ill. And I happened to become his last TA, his last teaching assistant. He taught this one class in science writing towards the end of his life. And he needed one TA for that class. And so I applied and got that spot. And it was really a lot of fun because it was a writing class. So the grading help that the TA provided involved grading essays. And Carl was actually very engaged in the grading of essays from his students. There had been over 3,000 applicants for that class, and only 25 were taken in. Okay, so 25 students, but still it was 25 essays to grade every week. And Carl was very engaged in that. But he,
of course,
he
being also, a great science communicator, he wanted to mentor people to be able to articulate science.
Yes.
Yeah,
exactly. But so he also wanted me to grade the papers as well with him, and so I had this entire semester where on Saturday afternoons I would be in Carl's living room.
Wow! What an honor.
Grading essays, you know, in the middle of all these memorabilia that had showed up in the Cosmos show, like the Rosetta Stone. That, you know, he had a replica of the Rosetta Stone in his living room, and. He had a funny story about that, too, because in the movie, in the TV series Cosmos, of course, at some point he's in Egypt explaining the value of the Rosetta Stone, where the same text basically shows up in three different languages. So they allowed people to, for the first time, decipher hieroglyphics. But he actually was explaining to me how he had trouble getting this replica of the Rosetta Stone out of Egypt a second time. The first time it was taken out of Egypt by Napoleon, essentially, by one of Napoleon's scientists, Champollion. And then it ended up in the British Museum. But it's still viewed as such a treasure. And so even getting his replica out of Egypt was a cause of, you know, some concern with customs, but he was eventually let out.
So when did you found the Mars Institute? Was that much later?
Yes. So after I graduated, I wanted to do more field work. I had never forgotten this incredible year I had spent in Antarctica. And so I wanted to go back to the poles. To me, they were a step closer to Mars. Mars is a cold planet. It's dry. It's frigid. And the polar regions of the Earth offer places like that, that are dry, cold. So I applied for a position at NASA Ames as soon as I graduated from Cornell. And I was lucky to work with Chris McKay there. Chris had been pioneering the study of Antarctica as an analog for Mars. And I essentially went to Chris with a project to go up to the Arctic instead, and to go to this remote island in the Arctic called Devon Island. And Devon Island is the largest uninhabited island on Earth. On it, there was this large impact crater, a meteorite impact crater. This one is much bigger than Meteor Crater in Arizona. Arizona's crater is about
the Barringer.
The Barringer Crater. Yeah, 1.2 kilometers across, 0.8 miles. This thing up in the Arctic is 20 kilometers across, 15 miles.
Wow.
So it's a biggie. Although, you know, in the big picture, it's still sort of a moderate size, medium sized crater. But anyway, Devon Island, as it turns out, is in this one part of the Arctic, in the North American Arctic, that's very cold and dry. Alaska is mostly tundra. It's cold and kind of wet. The bulk of the Canadian Arctic is cold and wet. It's tundra. This corner of the high Arctic is cold and dry. And so that's hard to come by, actually. And here we had an impact crater basically sitting in a cold, dry polar desert. And that is exactly how you would describe Do you want to take that?
Nope.
Okay.
Go ahead.
That is exactly how you would describe Mars. Barren, desolate, frigid, dry, polar desert, you know, scarred by impact craters and dissected by canyons, which we have on Devon Island as well.
What kind of research does one do in a place like that? Do you test the survivability of plants? Do you human survival tests? What's going on in Devon Island?
Yeah, my personal area of expertise is planetary geology. So I study the landscape of the Earth, and I try to draw comparisons or point out differences between the Earth and other planets, and mostly Mars, and sometimes the Moon. And that's the value that's the scientific research that I personally do. I study how the canyons on Devon Island, which look amazingly like the ones on Mars, formed. How the crater on Devon Island weathers away over time, and what climate implications that has for similar craters on Mars, etc. But the site is conducive to a much broader range of research, and so that was the basis of starting this project that followed our first visit to this site. So the first visit to this site was in 1997, geez, last century already. But within minutes of landing there, we realized that this was just going to be an amazing place for planning the future human exploration of Mars. So you imagine you get to this corner of the Arctic, you land there, and it's like landing on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
Coming with a helicopter, there's a plume of dust. I mean, it's just, and you know, you're at the rim of this crater, and the place is just mind-blowingly like Mars, and yet with differences. But anyway, so over the years we grew this project called the Houghton Mars Project. Houghton mm-hmm. is the name of the crater, Houghton Crater. Houghton Mars Project. It's funded mostly by NASA, but also by industry. We have lots of industry partners. And I might as well shamelessly make a call out to industry here. If you want to be a partner in this, you're most welcome. And what we do there each summer is, while there's a core team of people doing field science, mostly geology and biology, we are also in the process testing technologies for the future exploration of Mars. So, for example, this past summer, which was our 22nd consecutive summer on Devon Island. This past Amazing. Summer, we tested a Mars airplane, an electric Mars airplane designed by NASA Langley. So that's a NASA center that's in Virginia.
So Mars' atmosphere is about 1% of Earth at sea level. So that must be an amazing aircraft.
Exactly. So mind you, it wasn't so much the scaling of the aerodynamics that we were focused on. Because indeed, to maintain lift on Mars, you have to fly essentially, 10 times faster, or mm-hmm. have wings that are, 100 times bigger. But what we were focused on, it was sort of a new design of an aircraft and how it would allow us to land vertically as a VTOL, a vertical takeoff and landing aircraft, and transition into a long range. A horizontally flying airplane, and it's an aircraft design that could allow you to pretty much land anywhere on Mars on unprepared terrain. In other words, you do not need a landing strip, and at the same time not have the shortcoming of a helicopter, because a helicopter is very limited in range. Here you could fly fast and horizontally, and therefore have the range of an airplane. So this combo is not common. We're familiar with the tilt rotor, maybe of the V-22 Osprey. The U.S. Marine Corps uses mm-hmm. that as an aircraft. But that's an instance where the wings remain horizontal and the rotors tilt to allow you to land vertically and fly horizontally. In this case, the entire aircraft is shaped like a boomerang that you would land on its tips vertically, standing on its tips.
There was an experimental aircraft in the 50s like that. It didn't work out very well. Tail lander with an engine in the nose, and the pilot had to set it down on its quad tail.
But with the servos that now exist and the ingenious design by NASA Langley, it now flies very well. It would be ideal for Mars. So already on the next mission to Mars, we're going to have a helicopter on board designed by JPL. But we're thinking that on future landers on Mars, we will have something like this Mars electric flyer that was tested this past summer.
Cool. Well, I wanted to ask you as we close the segment number one, bring me up to date on the listeners. Do we have definitive firm plans to go to Mars in the 2030s? Is that on schedule and funded and firm? Or is that still up in the air?
Well, there isn't the driven momentum of an Apollo-like program yet. But I think it's fair to say that most of the people that I know at NASA who are working on advanced technologies and future human spaceflight are all thinking Mars, with Moon along the way and possibly other things along the way. But Mars is sort of the requirement, so to speak, to meet ultimately.
Isn't there a very favorable window around 2030 or 2033 that we don't want to miss?
Yeah, they come and go, these windows. I remember 35 years ago, I made a bet with some friends. This was back in Paris. And I told them, you know, by 2017, which is a historic favorable window to go to Mars, mm-hmm. 2017, the distance between the Earth and Mars reaches a minimum every 26 months. In fact, that's what defines the launch window cycle. But you got to take
a transfer orbit, which is longer duration than that.
Right. It takes about 9 months to get there.
Home transfer orbit. Yeah.
About 9 months to get out there. And then another 9 months to come back. But at the usual minimum distance between the Earth and Mars, when the Earth passes Mars, so to speak, as it goes around the sun, is about 56 million kilometers. In 2017, that distance dropped to close to 53 million kilometers. So it was a very favorable minimum.
I take it you lost your bet.
So I lost my bet, yeah, because we were nowhere near. But it's funny because that was the farthest bet in the future. In fact, I was deemed to be a complete pessimist and unrealistic about it.
Well, we got the 50th anniversary of the first moon landing coming up next summer.
Who would have thought
that's going to be painful? Yeah.
Who would have thought that 50 years after Apollo, we would still not have humans on Mars?
Wow.
But here we are.
All right. So we got to close out this first segment. In the second segment, I want to chat with you about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Yep.
Folks, I'm chatting with planetary scientist Dr. Pascal Lee. We'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm chatting with planetary scientist Dr. Pascal Lee. One of my favorite subjects in astrophysics is SETI, and yours too. You are a planetary scientist for the SETI Institute. SETI is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Why don't we open this segment by you bringing us up to date on the latest technology and projects as scientists search for extraterrestrial intelligence?
Well, the SETI Institute does a lot more than the sort of radio search and listening for extraterrestrial intelligence. The SETI Institute is interested in the origin, the evolution, the spreading, the outcome of life in the universe, and including our human future in space. And so the SETI Institute, incidentally, is based here in Mountain View in Silicon Valley, and it's just an amazing place to work at. But indeed, one of the Institute's main objectives is to search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And the SETI Institute has its own observatory that it has been building over the past years, called the Allen Telescope Array. And it's located at Hat Creek near Redding in Northern California. And so it's an amazing facility that is now online and is being used, listening at millions of channels at one time to search for signals out there.
I'm intrigued by that millions of channels thing. I'd like you to fill us in on that. When we first started, by we I mean the astronomers like Dr. Frank Drake, who started off with Project OSMA in 1960.
Yep.
The favored thought was to look on the hydrogen 21 centimeter line.
Right. Right.
And over time, the thought process changed a little bit. The reason is because hydrogen hyperfine transition sends out a radiation of 21 centimeters that percolates through the galaxy pretty easily.
Yep.
And we figured anybody who wanted to talk to us would jump on that wavelength. But since that time, thoughts have changed. And when you say millions of channels, are you talking about millions of frequencies?
Yep. There's almost a continuous coverage in frequency from about 0.5 gigahertz to about 11.2 gigahertz in the case of the Allen Telescope Array. Yeah.
Wow, that's a broad range. What is the thinking behind such a broad range in frequencies?
So what we are looking for is not only necessarily directed signals, but the usage of radio communications by any civilization that might be out there, and therefore radio, what's called radio leakage. And so if you look at the spectrum of what the Earth itself leaks into space, in fact, if you were to look at the 21 centimeter line, you'd see very little coming from the Earth, because we're not really transmitting.
But you'd see I Love Lucy at certain frequencies.
Exactly. But if you want to catch up on news from past century in particular, you just have to go out a few tens of light years out and you can listen. Yeah. And so there's a huge amount of broadband, multi-frequency leakage that's coming from the Earth.
Are there favorite frequencies like water molecule or oxygen lines or other favorite lines?
There are lines that we actually try to avoid because they coincide with natural emissions that you have in the galaxy.
Okay.
So you want to avoid those. But at this point, we're not just looking at what happens in one frequency, but if there are patterns and modulations. And
is it a smart thing to transmit on multiple frequencies at the same time?
So we're not transmitting.
I mean, no, but for the other guys.
Oh, well, like I said, it's leakage. It's not necessarily a directed signal from them.
Yeah.
The idea is that we might hear the noise, and we would recognize that noise as being non-natural.
Unintentional, yeah.
It's unintentional, but also non-natural. In other words, from a civilized, I shouldn't say non-natural, but I mean non-astronomical, just from a civilized, from a technology, in other
words. Is that because it's easier to pick up on accidental leakage than it is to statistically happen upon directed signals that just happen to come along at the right time in our right direction?
Yeah, it's more easy to detect and to ascertain as being the product of an intelligence. Yes.
Yeah.
But of course, all detections made to date are essentially from the Earth. There are a couple of mysterious bleeps that are not reproduced, and so of course we can't do anything with those either. But that's sort of the status of the search. But I have to say, I personally am not among the folks who are optimistic about the outcome of the search. The upshot, I think, of it all is that we should still search, and that's why I think we're still doing the right thing here.
I think you're nibbling around the edges of the Fermi paradox.
I am at the Fermi paradox.
Would you explain that to the listeners?
Sure.
Because they'll run across the term Fermi paradox a lot in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Enrico Fermi won the Nobel Prize in physics. And one of the interesting side things that he was interested in was the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And he formulated his paradox by pointing out that if there are so many intelligences out there, how come we haven't detected any? How come we're not seeing them? And that's known in the field of SETI as the Fermi paradox. Mm-hmm. If they're out there, why don't we see them? And there are many answers to that have been proposed. In fact, there are even books written about the various answers to the Fermi paradox. It could be that they don't care about us. They don't want to be detected by us. They keep it in a low profile.
Maybe some other bigger civilization besides Earthlings would come and tromp on them, keeping their head down.
or something that I credit to Carl Sagan is that the sure sign that there is intelligence out there is that they haven't tried to contact us. Things like that. Okay, there's a range of explanations for the Fermi paradox. To me, the most prosaic one, the most basic one, might actually be the real answer, which is there just aren't that many out there. Yeah. The premise of the Fermi paradox might not be correct. And the reason why I think, and I've been sort of giving some talks out there as a as a lone advocate, so to speak, of this view for the past few years is the reason why I think there aren't that many out there is because if you take a critical look at what's known as the Drake equation.
At this point, Comcast experienced a regional outage. It lasted for several hours. Due to Dr. Lee's tight schedule and his impending departure on another one of his Arctic expeditions, we were unable to resume the session when Comcast resumed service later. Even though we were almost finished, I'll invite Dr. Lee to come back on the show in the future to resume this fascinating discussion about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Dr. Lee had previously told me that the best way to contact him is MeTime, is on Twitter, @PascalLeeTweets. So that's the wrap for now. You've been listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. See you next week.